This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Whether or not you consider it a blue wave, Colorado voters showed overwhelming support for the Democratic Party in the midterms. We will have more on what this might mean for the state.
From farmers to landscapers, more Colorado employers are turning to a temporary visa work program to fill jobs that don't attract U.S. workers. It comes with its share of hurdles, though. We'll get a closer look at that.
Plus, have you looked up at the night sky lately? The skies over northern Colorado are getting brighter, and unfortunately, that is not from the stars.
The research is starting to really say that if we don't start getting some of this light pollution, night light pollution under wraps, then we're going to have impacts to us and to certainly the wildlife as well.
We'll hear about an effort to open the first official night sky park along the Front Range and Howie Moshevitz reviews a movie.
But first, Amazon finally announced their choice for where to locate their second headquarters, HQ2, and it was not Denver. But the group behind Denver's application says losing the bid for HQ2 to the East Coast isn't a total letdown. Sam Bailey is with the Metro Denver Economic Development Corporation. He says the city will keep in touch with Amazon on future projects.
It certainly has been a wonderful showcase for a region and huge validation for other companies looking into Metro Denver.
And of course, Amazon's also been growing its presence in Colorado over the past year. The company opened its third fulfillment center earlier in Thornton, as well as new offices in Boulder and a brick and mortar store that's in Lone Tree.
Medical professionals from across the country, including in Colorado, are pushing back online against the National Rifle Association. SKUNC's Lee Patterson reports it's focused on gun violence.
It all started when the NRA responded to a recent research paper on reducing firearm injuries and deaths by tweeting, quote, "Someone should tell self-important anti-gun doctors to stay in their lane." In response, enraged doctors and nurses tweeted about their experiences with gunshot wound victims, posting photos of bloody scrubs and operating rooms. In an email, Dr. Emmy Betts, a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, said, quote, "In my memory, this is the first time that the NRA so directly has told us to stay out of the area. Doctors and other healthcare providers have been engaged previously, but this time it feels particularly personal," unquote. Doctors are now circulating a petition, an open letter to the NRA, saying that they're not anti-gun, but anti-bullet hole, and inviting the group to be part of the solution. Lee Patterson, KUNC.
Colorado experienced a blue wave during last week's election, with Democrats holding on to the governor's office and, for the first time in 4 years, having control of both chambers in the state legislature. But each side has a different take on what one-party control will mean for the state. KUNC's Scott Franz has more.
Colorado Democrats also won races for every major state office on November 6th. The last time that happened, it was 1936, and that political reality is keeping some awake at night, including Republican State Senator John Cook of Greeley.
I don't see them compromising. I don't see they're coming to us and wanting to work with us. I see their radical agenda taking place.
As the results were coming in, the GOP election night watch party felt more like a wake for several state Republicans. Cook went as far as predicting that Democrats would run wild with their newfound power.
It's going to be like living in California or Oregon.
And state party chairman Jeff Hayes says Republicans won't take the change sitting down.
We'll be definitely keeping an eye on them and pointing out where they're wrong.
He's already calling on his party to serve as the loyal opposition to the Democrats. On the other side of the aisle, Democrats are trying to strike a more cooperative tone ahead of the legislative session, which begins in January. Leroy Garcia of Pueblo will lead the new 19-16 seat majority in the Senate.
What do you think the tone is going to be like with Republicans when the session starts?
I'm hopeful that it's positive, right? I mean, I'm optimistic that, you know, people who know when you were serving in the minority and now are in the majority have an opportunity to lead and govern, and that's what I want to do. And that is my task, is to lead and govern and to take this responsibility very seriously. I'm eager to work with anyone who wants to work with us.
Do Republicans like Hayes and Cook have a reason to worry? If history is a guide, Ken Bickers says they might. Bickers is a political scientist at the University of Colorado at Boulder. He has studied what happens when one party has complete control of a legislature.
When there's unified control, sometimes the parties reach further down their wish lists to try to get things enacted because they know this is their chance to try to push some things through that would not happen if they had to negotiate with the other body controlled by the other party.
But that can also have consequences. Bickers points to the 2013 legislative session. Democrats passed stricter gun control measures following the Aurora Theater shooting.
A recall election in Colorado sending a message in the national debate over gun control to state lawmakers who supported tighter gun control laws were voted out of office last night.
Bickers thinks a split chamber can be a blessing for lawmakers and the governor.
My sense is that the best years in the Hickenlooper administration have been when he had divided legislature, that because then he could work with Republicans and Democrats and try to reach across the aisle.
So what's on the wish list for Colorado Democrats? State Party Chair Morgan Carroll is giddy when she describes what she thinks the new Polis administration will accomplish with Democratic backing. She's predicting more environmental regulations will be passed, and the state will make larger investments in public education. Healthcare is also on her mind.
Most of the time people focus nationally at what's going on in healthcare, but really it's the state that decides who's included in Medicaid expansion, how much oversight do we have over the insurance industry is really the state insurance commissioner appointed by the governor.
The state might also see new regulations on oil and gas. Democrats introduced multiple bills calling for more regulations last session that died in the Republican-controlled Senate. I'm Scott Franz at the state capitol.
If you haven't done this lately, go outside. Look up at the night sky from where you live. How many stars can you see? You know, you might have a better celestial view if it weren't for so much light pollution. You can always go to something called a night sky park. Right now, Colorado has two such parks where all the stars shine especially bright. And KUNC's Matt Bloom says it could soon have a third in northern Colorado.
Oh, hey, anybody know this guy over here? Yeah, look at that. So here's the Big Dipper.
Rod Cerconi and I are strolling along a dirt trail at the Red Mountain Open Space in northern Larimer County, our necks craned up to take in the view.
That means then that these stars here lead you to the North Star right here, and the Little Dipper, yeah, here's the Little Dipper here. If you can see the stars in the Little Dipper, you got good clear skies. But to be able to see these here,
we're good.
That's amazing.
Cerconi is an amateur astronomer and night sky photographer. Above us, bands of the Milky Way float like clouds, and you can clearly make out both Jupiter and Saturn. But there's also a dome of yellow-orange light on the horizon.
That's Fort Collins.
Even here, about an hour's drive away from the city, it's impossible to escape.
This is all directly related to growth. I mean, if Fort Collins wasn't there, you wouldn't see that light out there. So the more people you have, the more houses, the more cars.
Which creates more light pollution. Northern Colorado's population is set to double by 2050, meaning it's going to get even brighter.
Us as humans evolved for millennia with a dark night sky, and only in the past 100 years or so have we really lost that.
Justin Sharton is an environmental planner with the city of Fort Collins.
So the impacts to circadian rhythms, stress, chronic illnesses, things like that, the research is starting to really say that if we don't start getting some of this light pollution, night light pollution under wraps, then we're going to have impacts to us and to certainly the wildlife as well.
About a year ago, Sharton and others launched an effort to control the problem. At the top of his to-do list, filing an application to get Red Mountain and the neighboring Soapstone Prairie areas certified as one big dark sky park.
Luckily for us, there's very little infrastructure up there.
The park designations are awarded by the Tucson-based International Dark Sky Association, and they're not easy to get. The IDA's Amanda Gormley says they require cities to take concrete steps to ensure dark areas truly stay dark.
Oftentimes it requires an inventory of the lighting and changing out lighting that's environmentally friendly and protects dark skies, and or working with the local government entities or decision makers to enact lighting ordinances that will protect the night skies.
So as a part of the application, Fort Collins recently changed its lighting code. It now requires new home and commercial developments to use only pollution-mitigating outdoor lamps. And staff like city engineer Gary Schroeder are encouraging owners of older homes to invest in new fixtures.
So this new light fixture is an LED light fixture.
With the owner's permission, Schroeder shows me a house on the southeast side of town that recently made the switch. It's pretty dark out, but the light clearly illuminates the front door.
It's got a black kind of circular hood around it, so it's providing that cutoff aspect that we want to prevent the uplight and side light and reduce the glare.
If everyone had these lights, he says Fort Collins, Light Dome, and other growing cities like Greeley and Loveland would be much, much smaller. But they're not cheap, about $60 a piece. It's a small price to pay if you ask night sky aficionados like Rod Cerconi.
Oh, this is great.
Back at Red Mountain, he snaps a photo of the Milky Way. Light pollution doesn't just get in the way of a good picture, he says. Most of us are so used to it that we forget to look up and enjoy the cosmos.
When I get my binoculars out, I didn't bring them this time, and I look at the Andromeda Galaxy, I like to think that there's somebody up there with a pair of binoculars looking down at me in our Milky Way. I don't know. It's mind-boggling.
The city of Fort Collins plans to submit its Dark Sky Park application by the end of November. A decision from the IDA could come as soon as early next year.
I can't believe the luck we had with the weather.
Matt Bloom, KUNC, Red Mountain.
And thank you, God, for clear skies.
All right, hang tight. We have a lot more great stuff to share with you, including what farmers do when they can't find the workers they need.
There's not a labor pool that would allow us to pick that volume of fruit all at once.
The H-2A visa program lets them hire temporary foreign workers, but it's costly and time-consuming. We'll get a closer look at that.
And we'll hear a new film review from Howie about a young man who was already a famous chef at the age of 12. That's pretty impressive.
That's when I started to learn how to cook ramen.
I think I was trying to learn how to microwave a potato at that point. Oh well, move over, Chef Lynn. The culinary professionals are right here. But before we get to that, a new ad campaign wants to make sure visitors to Colorado don't show up uninformed. KUNC's Stacey Nick has more.
Careful Colorado.
The Colorado Tourism Office recently released the video Are You Colorready on its website, colorado.com. The video features the song Care for Colorado, performed by an animated bear and moose. It also includes clips of a variety of issues that occur when people visit the parks and trails and don't respect the environment. The campaign is part of an effort to educate both visitors and locals and was created in partnership with the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics. Tips include not interfering with wildlife, picking up after pets, and looking for less frequently visited locations. Some of Colorado's most popular natural areas have become overwhelmed by increased foot and car traffic, as well as vandalism. Stacey Nick, KUNC.
When American farmers are unable to find the labor they need, the federal H-2A visa program allows them to temporarily bring in workers from foreign countries. As KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, the visas are costly for the farmers and the application process is time-consuming. Yet the number of them granted each year continues to climb.
For 100 years and five generations, Bruce Talbot's family has grown fruit on the western slope of the Colorado Rockies.
This is all peaches. And peaches have become our main thing.
Here in this high desert climate, farmers are known for the fuzzy fruit. It used to be that thousands of migrant workers came to this region each year for the peach harvest. But starting in the early 2000s, Talbot says the labor pool dried up. He's diversified his crop from just peaches to grapes, cherries, and pears because they all ripen at different times of the year.
There's not a labor pool that would allow us to pick that volume of fruit all at once.
But farmers, especially if they grow fruit and vegetable crops that have to be picked by hand, say they're not able to find labor locally anymore. So they're turning to the H-2A visa, so much so that a record number was granted in 2018, more than 240,000. That's a 21% increase from about a year ago. It's not a cheap program, and because of that,
it makes perfect economic sense to bring in workers for longer periods of time just because of that upfront fixed cost.
Fritz Roca is with the Department of Ag Business at Florida Gulf Coast University. He says farmers are learning to adapt to the cost and becoming increasingly dependent on the program. Harvest Public Media analyzed data from the Department of Labor and found fruit farmers and ranchers in states like Colorado, Illinois, and Missouri bring in H-2A workers early, around February. They keep them for up to 6 months to prune, plant, harvest, and package. Rocha says that's happening with Florida's citrus growers, too.
What people have been doing, the employers have been doing, is they bring in H-2A workers to harvest citrus, and they transition into these other crops, thereby extending their season.
Research from the University of California, Davis, suggests Mexican workers who have traditionally had these jobs are now able to find work in Mexico, thanks to an improved economy. And experts believe U.S. citizens are reluctant to take these jobs because they're seasonal and physically demanding. This year, Talbot contracted 42 H-2A workers. Like everyone, he's required to pay for the workers' travel, housing, and above minimum wage. He calls it a desperation program. Only 9% of the ag workforce is H-2A.
Expensive, cumbersome, slow to respond. We will start in a couple of weeks preparing for H-2A for next year, starting the advertising, the things that we're required to do.
Talbot says each worker has a fixed cost of about $1,000. He's learned that if he brings in workers at the beginning of the year and then keeps them working until late fall, he can still make a profit without having to raise costs for consumers.
We have planted crops that allow us to harvest over a long period of time, and a lot of what we are planting now is to fill in our slow periods.
The technology for fully mechanizing the harvest of hand-picked fruits like peaches is still a few years off. In the meantime, Rocha says if farmers want a reliable source of labor,
you have one option, that's the H-2A program. There just aren't options for domestic workers, especially legal domestic workers.
The extra work is ideal for the visa holders, too, because it's more money. At age 66, Marcelo Hernandez Ramirez has worked for seven seasons on the Talbot farm, where in 1 hour he earns more than twice Mexico's daily minimum wage of just $5. He says men in his hometown often ask how they, too, can get this visa. As he talks, he cuts bunches of dark purple grapes from their vines. Like the other H-2A workers here, Hernandez Ramirez is from Mexico. Each year, he spends 9 months working on Talbot's farm and then returns home for 3 months where he works in crops of wheat, corn, and beans. Congress has said it's planning to modernize the H-2A program and make it easier to use. But currently, there's no limit on the number of H-2A visas permitted each year. So as long as farmers like Talbot need help, the workers will come. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
This may come as a surprise, but more than half of all Colorado school districts have some or all of their schools operating on a four-day week. These districts are typically small or rural or both. But this year, one district in the Denver area made the switch. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel looks at how parents and teachers are adjusting to the new routine.
In 2017, voters in Adams County rejected a mill levy override that would have created additional funding for 27J schools and their nearly 18,000 students. It was the sixth time that such a measure failed. So as of this August, there's no school on Mondays.
We had to think out of the box.
Tracy Rednick runs the communication department at 27J. The district is one of the lowest funded in the Denver area, but money is not the main reason for going to a four-day week.
We were looking at new and creative ways to attract and retain teachers.
Traditionally, 27J has been a stepping stone for educators, but Rednick says moving to a shorter work week boosted recruitment. 500 prospective and experienced teachers showed up at their spring career fair, more than double from the year before.
It's a nice balance to have new teachers, but then also professionals that have been in the system for many years and are bringing their expertise to our district. So that's very valuable to us as well.
While a four-day school week may be an incentive for recruiting teachers, parents are still adjusting to the change, like Rebecca Williams of Brighton.
I started to initially panic because I was like, well, we work 5 days. What do we do on the fifth day?
This is why 27J offers childcare for elementary kids at some of their schools for $30 a day. William's son, Cade, is one of about 360 students enrolled in the program.
Testing, testing.
I'm going to say 1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3, testing, testing.
He already attended before and after care at his school, which cost $20 a day. Williams says adding another day is manageable.
So it's $10 more for all darn day. So it actually ended up being totally financially fine. So that was alleviated, and it's been very, very convenient.
Parent Rebecca Kanges had a similar reaction.
Where are my kids going to go? What am I going to do on that day off?
Fortunately, Kanges can work from her Commerce City home on Mondays, and that's saving her money because she can watch her 10-year-old son, Cooper, and his 5-year-old brother, Kayton.
That letter.
K.
What's the K for? What is it?
Kayton.
You know, I'm already spending $300 a month for my son to go to full-day kinder, and I just couldn't handle the idea of spending more money for daycare when I didn't have to spend that money last year.
As a parent, things are working for Kanges, but in her role as a professor of special education and the department chair at Metropolitan State University in Denver, she's skeptical of the district's stated reason that the change is mainly to hire and keep more teachers. So how's it going?
It's taken a while to get used to.
Dave DeVincenzi is a second grade teacher at Turnberry Elementary and has 3 children of his own.
I mean, I still love Mondays off, and I like the 4-day work week, and it kind of flies by.
He's in his 11th year with the district and says it's been an adjustment adapting to a work day that is now 40 minutes longer.
You know, you're trying to, you know, mentally plan and do curriculum for 5 days because all the curriculum plans are still on a 5-day rotation. We only have 4.
And Devin Chinsey's not sure if a shorter week will be enough to keep teachers.
We've all taught our whole careers with 5 days, so it's like, yeah, that's great and everything, but I think 4 days versus 5 days, I think teachers would still pick, you know, higher salary.
For now, Tracy Rudnick says the 27J school district is happy with the new schedule, adding that they will reevaluate things in 3 years.
We're moving forward and just being positive that all the things that we're putting in place, at the end of the day, it's all about the kids.
Even though parent Rebecca Kanges loves the district, she says the jury is still out.
I told my husband, you know, let's give this a year and see if there's positives or negatives or how we feel about it, and then we'll talk about if we need to move. What's that one?
S.
S? What does S say?
Stephanie Daniel, KUNC.
Good job. Nice work.
The new documentary, Chef Flynn, tells about a young man who became a famous chef by the time he was 12 years old. But for KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the movie forgets to focus on the person.
Most of the cliches and cutesy comparisons that can be made have been made about the young boy genius chef Flynn McGarry. He's been written about until you're fed up with the stories. Newspapers and local television news programs have gushed. The New Yorker wrote about McGarry when he was 13. He's been on the cover of the New York Times magazine. So, of course, there's a documentary about this kid. And given that he's now fundamentally available for dissection, director Cameron Yates has opened up yet another angle, Flynn's mother, Megan. The whole business reminds me of one of the early reality TV shows back in the 1960s. It was called An American Family, and for weeks PBS viewers watched the lives of the Loud family play out, and then the progressively desperate antics of the Loud family as it disintegrated under the pressure of constant TV coverage. Flynn McGarry is now 20. He's a celebrated chef, and he's been doing it since he was about 10. He's also been filmed and photographed so much since he was born that Flynn's life looks like it was constructed just for the sake of this film, something like Peter Weir's 1998 movie, The Truman Show. You have to wonder what's genuine about this kid and what's been fashioned for the sake of the show. His mother's been a filmmaker in Los Angeles, so this is her world. She seems to lap up the attentions of the filmmakers. She can seem like an attentive mother. She can also come off as intrusive and self-serving. At one point, Flynn tells an assistant to keep her away from the customers. She can come off as jealous of the attention her son gathers. Maybe the most accurate thing to say, though, is that here's the awkward portrait of a mother blessed and cursed by a son who's a genius. And what can a parent do in that situation? Who knows what her place might be and how she can best care for a son who's expert in the kitchen but is still a kid emotionally? It's fascinating to see Flynn McGarry's talents in action, especially if upscale cooking with tiny portions on big white plates is what you like. It can be disconcerting to see someone so young and so accomplished. Even at 10, he moves like a pro. He knows how to fillet a fish. He handles a knife with sure, elegant motions and no wasted movements. At a fish market, he sifts through a basket of abalone like someone who's been at the game for years. When he arranges food on a plate, he doesn't fiddle around. He knows what he wants to do. He understands color and shape and apparently taste. And he loves beets. It's impressive to see him as a 15-year-old organizing a kitchen, and even more impressive to see a kitchen staff of much older, more experienced people following his directions. But something about Chef Flynn seems off. It's hard to figure out where and how Flynn learned cooking in the first place, and you may wonder where the money comes from for him to put on lavish dinners in the family home, long before he became known and famous restaurants invited him to put on dinners. Maybe it's the unsettling sight of a kid being molded into a celebrity. His parents have him performing for their cameras from early childhood, as if they'd had all of this planned the moment young Flynn boiled his first egg. Chef Flynn shows a lot of Flynn McGarry, but not enough concern for him. It feels more like exploitation. Some perspective on this young man would be welcome, and maybe someone ought to worry about his overall well-being and not just jump on the bandwagon for a person who could easily crash as quickly as he rose. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofsovitz.
One last thing before we get out of here. I was able to meet up with a few people involved in a nonprofit organization called Wreaths Across America. Every year they collect donations for wreaths and ask people to come out and volunteer on December 15th to place wreaths on veterans and first responders' graves.
The snow covered the cemetery just like a blanket. And when it was all done, you could see footprints going from grave to grave as they placed their wreaths, and it was just very, very touching to see that those people who would not have been thought of that time of year were remembered. On the 15th of December at 10 o'clock at Lynn Grove, as well as all cemeteries across the nation who are participating with Wreaths Across America, we'll be placing evergreen wreaths on veterans' graves.
There's a kind of kinship that exists with me standing at Lynn Grove placing a wreath on a grave at the same time that my brother's doing the same thing at Arlington National.
Through the holiday season, we want to remember our veterans, those who have served, and now this year we're also including first responders.
I'm a military brat. My dad was career Army. As a part of that, it's so deeply ingrained in me that we do honor those who have served. We also have police officers and firefighters in our family, so we're very excited about honoring first responders this year.
I know some of the police officers out there, and to see the wreaths on their graves is going to mean a lot to me.
Everyone is welcome. We ask that you try to be out at the cemetery a little before 10, because we start the ceremony at the same time Arlington Cemetery starts their ceremony.
It just meant a lot that the people really care so much to do this. And to stand out there and place a wreath on the grave and say, Joe Jones, thank you for your service.
Show up and help and honor and remember and bring Kleenex.
To find out more information about Wreaths Across America or to volunteer, visit KUNC.org/get involved.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. Thank you. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana. We also heard Broke for Free with Murmur, C. Scott with Bellevue, Confluence by So Far As I Know,
Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, Dr. Turtle with You I'll Forest Robots with A Path Among the Woods, Uncanny with To Fight, and our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribing is the best way to do that. Find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And don't forget to join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.